I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working trying to bring...
Hey, Off Kilter listeners. The show is on a break this week, so we've rounded up some of our favorite conversations to hold you over in the meantime. First, I talk with Stephanie Land about her powerful memoir, Made, Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. Later in the show, a look behind the new documentary, Blowin' Up, which offers a glimpse into the lives of sex workers in Queens, New York, as well as the first ever problem-solving court for sex trafficking and prostitution in the U.S., which is also based in Queens. I talk with the film's director and the judge who presides over the court. But before we get into either, two important public service announcements. First, the deadline to comment on Trump's proposed rule to take food stamps away from as many as 1.2 million Americans was originally April 2nd. It has been extended by another week. This is because of a technical glitch that caused the Federal Register comment portal to stop accepting public comments for some period of time. So the U.S. Department of Agriculture has extended the comment deadline to April 10th. That means handsoffsnap.org will remain live and accepting comments until April 10th, midnight on April 10th. So keep those comments coming and keep sharing your thoughts and views on this rule, hashtag handsoffsnap. In case you're wondering, is this really worth your time? The answer is yes. Commenting can make a huge difference. As we talked about in last week's episode, the Disability Justice Initiative takeover of Off Kilter, a similarly destructive policy, so-called work requirements, in two states' Medicaid programs was recently blocked by a federal judge who himself cited public comments that had come in response to that policy as instrumental in his decision to reject those changes. Let's take a listen. Made is a dainty word, redolent of tea trays, starched uniforms, Downton Abbey. But in reality, the maid's world is encrusted with grime and shit stains. These workers unclog our drains of pubic hairs. They witness our dirty laundry, literally and metaphorically. Yet they remain invisible, overlooked in our nation's politics and our policies, looked down upon at our front doors. So opens the foreword to Made, Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive by Stephanie Land, who also serves as a community change writing fellow and a frequent contributor to Talk Poverty. Stephanie, thank you so much for taking the time to join the show.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So before we get into the book, for anyone who hasn't read it and isn't familiar with it at this point, share a little bit of your personal story and how you actually got to the place where you wrote this book.
Well, I graduated college in 2014, and I was a pretty adverse student. I was 35 years old and about to have my second daughter completely on my own. So I always like to tell people, imagine the scene in Juno when she's like walking down the hall, like hugely pregnant, and people are like partying to make room for her. That was kind of what college was like for me. And I needed to work, and I told myself I was going to put my degree to work as much as possible. I got a degree in English, and so I took on any job where I was writing or editing work. And that counted. It led to a lot of really strange places, like filling in community calendars. But eventually I published an essay on Vox Media, and it went wildly viral. And that morning, my agent contacted me through my website and asked me if I had a book in the works, and I lied and said yes. And he's like, great, send me a few chapters. And so I wrote a few and sent them over, and 11 months later, we sold the book on proposal, and then I had about a year to finally write it. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, how the book came about.
And the book is structured, each of its chapters is actually a story about a particular house that you used to clean. And the title of the book, Made, is perhaps self-evident in what it's describing. But it starts with you and your daughter moving out of a shelter into transitional housing not long after you were forced to leave the home that you were sharing with an abusive partner.
Yeah, and I originally kind of saw the stories arc as me finding home while I was kind of finding things in other people's homes that like told me about their lives. And so each chapter is not only arranged around the houses that I was cleaning, or what I called the houses that I was cleaning, but they also include like the places where we were living as well. And I really like the kind of juxtaposition of like me living in this 300 square foot studio apartment and then going and cleaning these houses that were overlooking the entire town and had 6 bedrooms and 5 bathrooms. And then I would return home to this tiny little space and not really see much difference in how we lived our daily lives, you know. And it really made me feel a lot of gratitude for this tiny little space that I shared with my daughter. We didn't have much room to go hide it. So we were kind of forced into this like relationship that now looking back, I really cherish.
One of the themes that really is a through line of the entire book, even though there's tremendous diversity and a lot of kind of uniqueness to each of the places that you describe, experience having cleaned, but is this theme of invisibility. I'd love for you to read actually a passage from the book that talks a little bit about this.
Sure. So this is out of the chapter, the Chef's House. They worked to pay Classic Clean, who paid me just above minimum wage to keep it all spotless, in place, acceptable. While they paid for my work like some magical cleaning fairy, I was anything but that, shuffling through their house like a ghost. My face had an ashen hue from lack of sun, dark circles under my eyes from lack of sleep. Usually my hair was unwashed, pulled back into a ponytail or under a handkerchief or hat. I wore pairs of Carhartt cargo pants until the holes in the knees were unsightly enough that my boss told me to replace them. My job afforded me little money to spend on clothes, even for work. I worked through illnesses and brought my daughter to daycare when she should have been at home. My job offered no sick pay, no vacation days, no foreseeable increase in wage, yet through it all, still I begged to work more. Wages lost from missed work hours could rarely be made up. And if I missed too many, I risked being fired. My car's reliability was vital, since a broken hose, a faulty thermostat, or even a flat tire could throw us off, knock us backward, send us teetering, falling back toward homelessness. We lived, we survived, in that careful imbalance. This was my unwitnessed existence, as I polished another's to make theirs appear perfect.
It's such a powerful passage, and that last sentence that you just read is just, it was one of the ones that resonated with me just so incredibly strongly in reading this book. You describe how you were seen, if by anyone, by the houses that you were cleaning. You actually describe the houses having watched you go through its phone book to find churches that might donate funds to help pay rent after you learned that the wait list for public housing was 5 years long. That house knew me and you knew it. There are so many of these moments throughout where you feel seen not by the people who are paying you to clean their houses, but really more almost by these homes themselves. Will you share a little bit of some of the experiences you had going into other people's houses and seeing so much of their lives when they really never saw you at all?
I feel like it was a process of kind of a disenchantment. I originally went into the job thinking that the house on the hill meant happiness. Like everybody in there was singing and dancing and they had unicorns in there. Like I thought like that was the perfect, absolute perfect existence. There could be no sadness, unhappiness. I was very naive with that. And when I started cleaning their houses, I noticed that they still got sick, and that surprised me because they had access to doctors and prescriptions and healthy food and yoga, you know, all of this stuff that is supposed to keep you healthy. And then, you know, I started noticing the bottles of pain pills that were kind of left out everywhere, or just little clues that they worked very hard, even through illnesses, just like I did, and through chronic pain. You know, they still struggled with mental illness. And to me that was a little shocking. And it really made me reflect on my life and think, like, I would probably benefit from some of those things, care for, I have a condition called scoliosis. It's a really bad back. I would have benefited from therapy, and I'm sure we would have benefited from a regular doctor and all of those things. But when it came down to it, I saw my life completely differently. I had kind of like what I said before, I had this ability to experience life without all of these distractions, or without feeling like I had to work so hard and nonstop for spaces that I paid someone else to maintain. That just felt so empty to me to go into these houses regularly and just go over the vacuum lines that I had left 2 weeks earlier.
Invisibility is a theme that you also lift up a lot through your own public sharings, whether that's on Twitter and social media, talking about how people might be able to actually ensure that people do feel seen, particularly house cleaners and maids in hotels and other individuals who otherwise are so invisible. Would love to hear you talk a little bit about the perspective that you've gained by being on that side of this type of work.
Yeah, so when I worked for the cleaning service, a lot of my clients had no idea that I was a new person in their home. And then even though I was there for about a year, they never really learned my name. I was just the cleaning service on the calendar. And it's a really weird position to be in, especially I saw a client in a grocery store once and knew everything about her instantly, and she had no idea who I was. And I have been noticing, especially as I was traveling around on book tour, I started counting or trying to count how many people had a job that was basically making my life easier. I'd check in the hotel and, so there's the whole staff, there's the doorman, there's the cab driver who got me there, there's the people in the airport, the stewardesses, there's all of these people who just cater to people who can afford to stay in hotels and fly places and go out to eat. And so it just feels like there's this invisibility happening along with the class divide. We kind of expect all of these people to take care of us, and we're not taking care of them. We're not offering them a living wage, health insurance, enough money to buy food, housing. I can go on and on. Yet we expect them to cater to us, and we feel entitled to that.
You described just a moment ago the toll that this type of work took on you physically. The book is rife with discussion of back injuries, and you were describing scoliosis, which already sets you up to have back pain, pinched nerves, illness. You describe the mental toll, particularly because of feeling so devalued, as you've been describing. But the book also really tells the story not just of your own health, and that the toll that this type of work and that poverty itself took on you, but also on your daughter, Mia, who faced real health challenges growing up, a lot of that having to do with poor living conditions.
Yeah, she was constantly sick with something or another. And a lot of that is just a kid being in daycare. But the places that we lived it was Northwest Washington, so it's pretty common that there's a lot of mold issues. But ours was really making us sick. And she had one infection after the next, whether it was a sinus infection, an ear infection, or pink eye, or anything. And she is sensitive to antibiotics. And so I couldn't really just keep throwing antibiotics at her, and I couldn't stay home with her when she was sick. and me as well. Like I couldn't take a day off when I was sick. And she eventually had surgery for ear tubes and started to get a little bit better. And then by the time we made it to Montana, we hardly ever get sick at all. So it was a noticeable difference in just where we lived and how much that affected our health.
I read a little bit in the beginning from the foreword of your book, which is actually by Barbara Ehrenreich, who listeners to the show may be familiar with. She's been on the show, although not in a couple of years. But folks may be familiar with her from having written Nickel and Dimed, a 2000 investigative account of what it's like living in the United States while working at minimum wage jobs. Now, Barbara Ehrenreich, that was a very different exercise, that book, than yours, because she put herself into that situation as an investigative journalist who cut herself off from her resources and did that work so that she could gain that perspective for purposes of writing the book. Your experience is lived in not a journalistic way, but in the fact that that was what you were living at the time. But she writes the foreword for this book, and there's a lot of significance in her being the person to open this book. How did you come to get to know her? Tell me a little bit about that relationship and what that's meant to you as an up-and-coming writer on issues related to poverty.
Well, I pitched the Economic Hardship Reporting Project after I read an article of hers in The Atlantic that said something of the sort of poor people can't afford to write about their lives. And she talked about her organization and what they do to support writers. And I immediately pitched them about being on food stamps and social media at the same time and how much shaming is not necessarily directed at me, but one that I feel very heavily. And so I pitched her and it was pitched their slush pile or whatever. It was picked up, and I ended up writing for them several times over a course of a few years, I think almost 4 years now. And when it came time to put the book proposal out on submission, I just so happened to have an op-ed in the New York Times that EHRP was supporting. And then we asked them if Barbara might be able to write a blurb for the proposal. And they agreed. And I think like it just seems like a natural thing for her to write the foreword, but it was still pretty unnerving. Or just I was fangirling a lot. I met her for lunch in D.C. I was there for a convening with Community Change, and popped over to lunch and had lunch with Barbara Ehrenreich and asked her to write the foreword for my book. And she agreed. And it was pretty amazing that worked out in the way that it did.
And she's explicit in how she talks about, and she actually discusses this in the foreword, but she's explicit in how she talks about the difference between her journalism and your accounting in this book. She actually says, there was no way I was going to, quote, experience poverty or find out how it, quote, really feels to be a long-term low-wage worker, an incredibly important caveat that I feel is important to note here. But so much significance in the fact that her career in the wake of Nickel and Dimed has, as you note, been heavily devoted to trying to create platforms that enable people to be able to write about poverty and related issues from lived experience, given how hard it can be to make a living writing, let alone writing about poverty, which now you have really risen to a national platform in doing, but not necessarily because it was easy to get where you are now.
Yeah, well, one of the things that happened was I became a writing fellow through what they're now calling themselves the Community Change. When I started, it was the Center for Community Change. And that fellowship brought with it a stipend. And for a freelance writer who's just starting out, like having a regular paycheck was amazing. I think I got like $800 a month too. It was like this huge amount that could cover all of my fixed bills at that time. And that was such a stress relief. And, but it was also, hugely, supportive. And my person that I usually talk to, I still call her my boss, was Marisol Bayo. And she took on the writing fellowship program. And when I started, they only had four. And I think that number has grown to maybe the 40s, and now it's down to 17. It's mainly run by her. And now, you know, they're still doing the same thing. It's, you check in once a week and have this hour long conversation about like what's going on in your life, what things you're working on, where you think you can place them. And then Marisol was always the one who edited my pieces and then helped me place them, or, she would okay pitching it to a certain publication. And she really taught me how to be a journalist. I had no journalism background, and she was the one who, you know, taught me how to frame articles in like a more journalistic format, that like an opinion piece or along those lines. And I learned so much from talking to her and working with her for, again, like almost 4 years.
And I really appreciate Marisol getting named in this context, given her leadership in this space and how much work she's done over the years. She used to be at USA Today and left that journalism career to do this kind of work to support up-and-coming writers like you. And she's just an amazing colleague and friend. Don't go away. More Off Kilter after the break. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hey, Off Kilter listeners. The show is on a break this week, so we've rounded up some of our favorite conversations to hold you over in the meantime. Embodied in a lot of what you're talking about, and part of why I'm asking that question, is because, and we talk a lot on this show about this very principle, is just the sheer importance of people with lived experience of poverty and of economic hardship being the ones to weigh in on the kinds of policy change that we need. Something that you actually say quite explicitly in your book, you credit luck with part of why you're not now in the situation you were in, where you were cleaning houses and struggling so mightily to get by and to provide for your family. But it was more than luck, it will be more than luck that we need for other people in large numbers to be able to attain economic stability. And that's a lot of what you talk about when you talk about poverty and inequality. Your story underscores in so many ways the need for policy change. You just mentioned just a couple of minutes ago the need for a living wage. What is it that you hope that people take away from this book when it comes to specific policy changes that you would like to see?
I would like to see work requirements abolished. I think there is absolutely no need to require someone to work 20 hours a week for a little over a dollar a meal per person in their home. There are so many things wrapped up in safety net programs that are based out of mistrust and this sense that people are taking advantage. And I think we just need to let that go. I think we just need to give people the resources that they're asking for without requiring them to prove every 3 to 6 months that they're actually working in the places that they say that they are, or for however many hours. And we need to look at the welfare cliff. We need to stand at the bottom of it and see how high it actually is and how impossible it is to jump off of that. And, you know, let people save money. Let people have assets and resources. I don't think people really enjoy being on government assistance. It's not great. It doesn't feel good. It's a relief, you know, but I think average person wants to be able to provide for their families. And they want to have jobs that they're proud of and that they can support all of their family's needs with that income. And we kind of tell this story to ourselves that because of maybe we saw one person buying a steak on food stamps, that everybody does that. And it's just like play money. And you just like pick up the phone or click something on the internet and you suddenly get all of this money. And it's really not like that at all. It's incredibly hard to get government assistance and then remain on it.
And that's another theme that really echoes throughout your book. Yeah, there's just this rampant classism and so many myths about poverty that are what fuel the level of stigma and shame and then drive the kinds of policies that you're describing, like policies that take food or housing or healthcare away from people who can't hit a certain number of work hours. Some people call those work requirements. I choose not to use that phrase when I can avoid it because it's so misleading. There's also drug testing and so many other policies that are founded entirely on false premises and myths and classist ones at that about people who struggle to make ends meet. There's one scene in your book where a man actually yells at you, "You're welcome," when you're leaving a checkout counter at the grocery store. You had just paid for groceries with food assistance through a program called Supplemental Nutrition Assistance for Women, Infants, and Children. Some people might know it as WIC. And shortly before that, you had actually heard a client whose house you had cleaned for comment on having seen a Latinx family using an electronic benefit transfer EBT card, which is what people use for food stamps, while, quote, dressed to the nines. Would love to hear you talk a little bit about classism and these myths as really something that you encountered and have now seen on both sides.
Yeah, we grow up, I mean, as you just kind of said, a myth. It's an American dream, right? It's the, you work hard, you play by the rules, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, and you'll make it in this country. And it's just absolutely not true. But the problem with that is that the people who believe that myth, if they see someone who's not making it, then they automatically assume that they're not working hard enough. And that has been fed by narratives that we've had for decades. You know, we have the welfare queen, and we have this like phrase, sitting on the couch eating bonbons all day. We're at some kind of default level thinking that if a person doesn't have any money, it's just because they're not working hard enough. And the truth is they are working very hard in most circumstances. But we also don't talk about all of the invisible work that poor people have to do that that privileged people don't. And yeah, like I am still amazed that I have a huge thing of toilet paper in my garage. Like that just blows my mind every single time I see it. Like it's so easy to just go to these like huge warehouse stores and stock up. Like when I was in poverty or living under the poverty line, I could only afford a 4-pack of toilet paper, at a time. And I often couldn't afford shampoo or toothpaste. And so it was a constant stress just to keep myself stocked with toiletries. And that's something that a lot of people don't think about, I think, just how much, constant work is required when you are just barely getting by and barely able to pay the bills. Like there are a lot of things that are convenient for people with means. Like you can stop and grab something to eat. You can, okay, well, the coffee maker didn't work this morning, I'm just going to stop at Starbucks on the way in. Like there's, so, and you can stop in a car that runs really well and never breaks down. And I could just go on and on and on. Poor people do so much work that is so invisible on top of these jobs that they're getting paid minimum wage for, and then taking care of their families and doing all of the housework because they can't hire help. Like there's, it's just, it's unimaginable, to me how people don't see that.
something that this book explicitly notes and that we haven't talked about yet, but that I would be remiss if I didn't mention, is race. You reflect and openly in the book on the significance of the fact that you actually don't look like the type of poor person that so much of the mainstream media or really broad swaths of white middle class America likes to villainize. And you're not the same face that maybe comes to mind when people say things like welfare queen. You have a powerful quote from this from the book where you say, maybe they saw in me the chance of their own fragile circumstances, that with one job lost, one divorce, they'd be in the same place that I was. Would you talk a little bit about how it's been to be out there on book tour, talking about this book, talking about poverty, recognizing that you're just one face, and often in many ways not some of the most important faces of poverty in this country?
Well, on book tour, I mostly looked out at white audiences. And a lot of those audiences had house cleaners at home. And you know, I kind of toured around in wealthy areas, or, you know, middle class. And I pointed that out a lot, like, and kind of called them on their privilege as much as I could, as soon as any question, even close or alluding to race, came up. I kind of went off on this whole spiel about, you are listening to me because I look like you. Like, you are listening to the story because I am, you know, quote unquote, articulate or whatever, and I am successful. Like, people like to hear success stories, and I would call them out on that too. I just said, I'm not here because I went from welfare to work. I'm here because this crazy thing happened to me and I got a book deal and now everybody's reading it. Because I am coming from a place of, I think, likability, you know, like we like to hear from people who aren't angry, you know, aren't in systemic poverty, aren't in or involved in any life that might bring them systemic racism. You know, we like to hear from people who kind of have our similar background. But I also think that, the reason for that is, poverty is a scary thing. Like, imagine losing everything and having to live with your car, or live in your car with your family. And that's a scary, very vulnerable thing to imagine. And most people are terrified at that thought. And so what they like to do is, they look at a person who is struggling, and this happens to me all the time. They pick out all of the things that I did wrong and all of the bad decisions that I made. And because they didn't make any of those bad decisions, they set themselves up a little bit better. Then I won't ever be in, or they won't ever be in the same place that I am. And it's kind of like this hugely, like, big defense mechanism that people do. And it's damaging too, because then they tell themselves, oh, well, they brought this on themselves, so why should I have to help them? And I think the further they distance themselves from, you know, people in poverty, like, I'm using air quotes for that, like, or these populations who are struggling, the further away they feel from a need to really help them in any way.
It's a powerful note to end on. I've been speaking with Stephanie Land. She's the author of Made, Hard Work, Low Pay, and A Mother's Will to Survive. She's also a writing fellow with the Center for Community Change, now called Community Change, and a frequent contributor we're honored to have over at talkpoverty.org. Stephanie, thank you so much for taking the time to join the show.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Don't go away. More Off Kilter after the break. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
Hey, Off Kilter listeners, the show is on a break this week, so we've rounded up some of our favorite conversations to hold you over in the meantime. You're listening to Off Kilter. I'm Rebecca Vallis. Nestled in one of New York City's outer boroughs is the Queens Human Trafficking Intervention Court, that rare place in the American criminal justice system that seeks not to re-traumatize and lock up women who work as sex workers, but to treat them as actual human beings. Through director Stephanie Wong Breyal's empathic and feminist documentary Blowin' Up, which hits theaters this week, viewers get a rare glimpse into the lives of women who are just trying to survive, and the lawyers and judges who are trying to help them. To tell the story behind the first ever dedicated sex trafficking court in the United States and the women who pass through it, I'm thrilled to talk with Stephanie Wong Breyal, the film's director, as well as the judge that presides over the court, the Honorable Toko Sarita. Stephanie and Judge Sarita, thanks so much for taking the time to join the show.
Thank you for having us.
So, Stephanie, I'd like to start with you just to ask you to tell a little bit of the story behind this documentary and what got you onto the trail of making a film about sex workers and this particular court.
So I became interested in Judge Sarita's courtroom because I read an article in the New York Times in 2014 written by Liz Robbins about her courtroom, and when I read the article, I was fascinated that it was a space treating two populations of women that I have, that my previous work has focused on, women and young girls who have come through the foster care system, as well as Asian female immigrants. And when I found out that this court was serving these women and it was led by a Japanese female judge, my curiosity was piqued. And I forwarded the article to my business partner and producer, Carrie Weprin, and told her we should go and take the F train and check this place out. And so we did. And, you know, the first time we walked in the courtroom, we were immediately taken that this was a space completely occupied by women and mostly women of color. And I think that most people, when they think of the criminal justice system, they don't think of it as a space full of women, but sort of they, most people talk about the mass incarceration of men and not women. And so I was really interested in understanding who these women were and what are do these terms mean, this idea of being arrested for a prostitution arrest, and this idea that the women are actually victims of human trafficking, and some of them are claiming that they're just sex workers. What do all these terms mean, and who are the women that are these terms are supposed to represent? And so, you know, we continue to observe the courts and learn about the system and learn about the words and learn about the people and learn about the relationships. And slowly, over a 10-month period of time, were we able to convince the Judge Sarita, as well as the stakeholders of the Queens Human Trafficking Intervention Court, to allow us to actually bring cameras into the space so that we could start the filming process and start the beginnings of what would come to be Blowin' Up.
Judge Sarita, I would love to turn it over to you next to tell the story behind the court itself. And in the process, if you could share a little bit of some of the profiles of the types of women who come through this court.
Sure. I want to start off by saying that I was not the one who created the court. The court was actually created in 2004 by one of my colleagues who is also a judge of color. His name is Fernando Camacho, and he was very, very concerned about the young women that he was seeing in court who were clearly being trafficked, but, you know, was going through the revolving door. and not getting any services, and, you know, we're being treated as criminals. And so I took over the court in 2008. At that time, he had engaged in a partnership with GEMS, which is Girls Educational Mentoring Services. The executive director was Rachel Lloyd, and it was an alternative to incarceration program. And slowly but surely, every year, the numbers increase, and so we started engaging with more service providers in order to, you know, meet the needs of individuals coming through the court system. And basically, it was based on recognition that there were domestic victims of trafficking, right, arrested on prostitution, loitering charges, who were being criminalized and arrested, and there was no recognition taking place that they were, in fact, being exploited or trafficked. And so, you know, it was a way to redress some of the inequities inherent in the criminal justice system.
The film itself opens with an incredibly powerful set of remarks by and very kind of powerful opening sharing by a woman who's describing that what got her into sex work in the first place was the need to put up cash bail for a loved one, her significant other. There's a lot in there, right, in terms of the ways in which the criminal justice system is piling onto itself and the layers that this film really pulls apart. But that's just one profile of a person featured in this film. Judge Sarita, who are some of the other people and what are the other types of fact patterns that you see in this court?
Absolutely. You know, part of the reason why I decided to name it Human Trafficking Intervention Court was because there was no recognition that trafficking was taking place amongst domestic defendants, in particular young African-American girls and women. So in my court, we see mostly women of color. We see Asian, undocumented Asian women who I would say account for maybe 40% of the defendants who come through the courts, as well as transgender Latina women as well. And so what we've tried to do is partner with a number of different service provider organizations to meet the specific needs of, you know, the various populations, so that we can, intervene and connect them to a lot of basic services that they need.
And Stephanie, one of the things that, and as I'm hearing Judge Sarita talk a little bit about this, that, you know, woven throughout so much of how you guys talk is also consistent with really the through line of this film, which is the absence of judgment. You present people who are going through or have gone through incredibly trying life circumstances, committing crimes of survival in many cases. But the way that the film presents this is so fundamentally different from the stigma and the shame and the way that our society depicts sex workers. Even the very choice of language, sex worker, is a very different term than so many of the other dehumanizing frames that our society and the mainstream media throw up in describing the people who are profiled in a very different way in this film. Tell me a little bit about how you approached the filmmaking process so that was the through line and the feel in such a tangible way.
So when I walked into the space, as I had mentioned earlier, I was sort of amazed by all the different women who were working together to create the sort of collaborative sort of criminal justice system that was changing the way that these women were treated. And I knew during that sort of research and development period that I wanted to figure out a way to highlight sort of all these different perspectives and all these different roles and all these different dilemmas that were present in this space. Because I think that for me to document just the actions of the women without them saying what they're doing, but showing us what they're doing and what they represent would be so much more powerful for us to experience than hearing them telling us who they are, what their job is. So I approached the filmmaking process with this idea of, like, how can I create a portrait of this system? A portrait that represents not just
the perspective of Judge Sarita and the counselor, Eliza Hook, but also the perspective of the female defendants who are entering this space for the very first time, having really not any sense of what is going to happen or what this place is, who these women are, who their lawyer is. So I opened the film with just a real cinema verite style of filmmaking where you're just immersed in the space. There's no cards, there's no lower thirds or IDs pointing out who you should be paying attention to. I really want the audience to come into the space like I did and like the female defendants, not knowing what's going on and trying to figure it out for themselves what these words mean, what this space represents, and who these women are. Because only then I think that we could begin to understand all the complex choices that are involved and all the complex dilemmas that are involved when we're dealing with a subject matter as complicated and divisive as sex work and prostitution and human trafficking.
It's also notable that the way that you approach the filmmaking process it must have been incredibly challenging and required a great deal of thought and sensitivity, telling the stories of people who have experienced great trauma, as so many of the women in this film have, can be incredibly challenging. It can be a really hard balance to strike. How did you handle that dynamic as you were telling the stories and shining a light on stories that you felt so strongly needed to be told, but in such a sensitive way?
So, you know, there was no aspect of this filmmaking process that was easy. In fact, no one really wanted us to make this film, including Judge Sarita herself. And, you know, once we got Judge Sarita's formal, like, permission to come in with our cameras, every single thing that we filmed from there on was also another conversation, another discussion, another, you know, it wasn't just like once we got access to filming in the court, everything else was a carte blanche. It took us many moments of understanding and discussion to figure out how people wanted to be portrayed, what were the creative barriers that we had to think about when filming this. And for me, it was really important, you know, I understand, like, the power of the filmmaking dynamic, and I wanted to make sure that everyone felt like they were collaborators in this process. So, you know, my producer, Carrie, and I, we listened a lot to what people felt comfortable with, because at the end of the day, we knew that as long as we set up the environment for them to feel comfortable, we would get the most intimate and honest stories, and that's what's going to help people understand what's going on. And so that's just been a really important and integral aspect of all of my filmmaking process. And, you know, I just applied this to this space as well, because it is a space full of trauma and challenges and fear and shame and repercussions. So I really, my whole filmmaking team, we all took, you know, we all had a lot of intention every time we went into that courtroom, and the way that we respected and treated everyone who was participating in the filmmaking process.
Judge Sarita, what is it that people in this country maybe don't know about sex workers and sex work and how people come to it and the nature of it? What would you hope that people do take away from this film, given the glimpse into your courtroom that it provides?
I think that in the same way that the film is non-judgmental, I would like people who see the film and who start approaching this issue to be non-judgmental about those who are working in the sex industry, whether as sex workers or whether as trafficking victims. Because one of the things that I have encountered is the degree of shame, of stigma, of rampant cultural stereotypes that are used to degrade and dehumanize women and men who work in the sex industry. And so my hope is that, you know, the perceptions which are so deeply entrenched in this very, very puritanical country that we live in start shifting slowly but surely, so that people are given their dignity, do not have their human rights violated, and are able to lead their lives, you know, with the self-determination and agency, because that's something that we do not see at all in terms of the populations that we deal with in the courts.
Stephanie, do you support the legalization of sex work? That was a question I had in my mind almost the entire time I was watching this film, thinking about how a problem-solving court is obviously a much better alternative than locking people up and punishing them for crimes of survival, and in many cases punishing people who themselves are the victims of crimes and should be treated as such. But do you support, and do you believe that the conversation we should be having as a country is about not just treating people humanely who otherwise would be chewed up and spat out by our broken criminal justice system, but outright legalization of sex work itself?
Yes, I do support the legalization of sex work. I do think that Judge Streeter's courtroom is an amazing place that is singular in the way that it humanizes and treats these women. And I think that it is a step in the right direction for our country in terms of understanding who these women are and where they're coming from, and trying to change the way that they are prosecuted. And the fact, you know, one question that keeps coming up throughout the film, and that I hope the film raises for individuals, is why are these women being arrested in the first place? You know, and so I think that if we could eliminate that question, then we could have a better understanding of, you know, if that wasn't happening, then we wouldn't be dealing with this courtroom or these issues in the first place. But on the same hand, I also believe that there are women who are being trafficked and who do need access to services and programs and people who can help them find another way out of the life. I think that the sex working spectrum is vast and large, and I think that legalization will help sex workers who do have agency and who do this and who should have choice to do what they want with their bodies. I have no qualms with that. But I also think that we also need to continue to support women who aren't on that side of the spectrum, but who are, you know, involved in this business because of other circumstances in their lives.
And same question to you, Judge Sarita, and I ask you that recognizing you are a judge and your job with that hat on is to enforce the laws that exist. But do you have views on whether we should be decriminalizing or outright legalizing sex work?
Mm-hmm. I often say that, you know, it would be great if one day there was no need for a human trafficking intervention court. And I think in terms of the discussions that are taking place today, there is universal consensus that laws specifically around prostitution and loitering, right, which hurts most of the victims that we see in the courts, should be repealed. I think the controversy stems around whether or not this should extend to the repeal of all prostitution laws, right, other than sex trafficking, which is in a sphere of its own. That's something that I'm not going to get involved in, because my main concern, and so I don't have a problem, you know, I think we're all on the same page as far as the harm that these two specific laws are having on a very marginalized and victimized population. One of the things that has happened in the past, like, 2 years is that the New York City Police Department has instituted a policy where they have not been arresting as many individuals, you know, on these charges because of their recognition that many of them are victims, right, or victimized by a number of factors in the commercial sex industry. That's great, but on the other hand, I have real concerns about, you know, what is happening to all of those individuals who are out there, who are not getting services, who are still in the shadows, who are still very, very underground. Because I think that in terms of our societal response, it's not as if trafficking is going to go away. It's not as if, you know, we just by not having arrests, you know, these women out there are going to be connected to services. So I think that this is, you know, an issue that all of us have to be really, really concerned about. And, you know, the one thing that I have a real issue is the, you know, dichotomization of trafficking victim on the one hand and sex worker on the other. I think that, you know, there are sex workers out there who are absolutely entitled to their agency. And there are also a lot of trafficking victims out there as well.
It's such an important point, and one that I appreciate you making. Human trafficking is certainly an important component of this conversation and of the film. That's where the women are in many cases victims of scams, of horrible immigration sort of preying upon them because of undocumented status and so forth. But many sex workers choose the work as a source of income in some cases because of lack of better options, but in some cases because of agency and because of that being the choice that they want to make. Stephanie, back over to you for a moment. What is the significance of the title of this film? It's called Blowing Up, and it suggests to me that there might be a double meaning here, because on the one hand, it's described actually in the film in the voice of some of the sex workers profiled as the slang term for leaving a pimp and getting out of the life. But are there other meanings as well? And what was the significance of choosing that title for this film?
Yeah, I love Candy's testimonial overall, and I loved her agency and how she presented herself and her story. And so I loved it when she told us that, you know, she blew up when she decided to leave her pimp and go out on her own. And I also thought that that title was so, that language was so good to describe this courtroom as well, because in some ways I felt like watching Judge Sarita and Eliza and Kim and all the women and me and all the women working in the court, they were trying to blow up the way that the criminal justice system treats women and girls arrested for prostitution by bringing humanity, compassion, and empathy into a space that is, a criminal justice building. But I also thought it was extra meaning as the filming continued, and once ICE came into the courtroom, that in some ways what they had created, this small ecosystem of, you know, sanity, was being blown up by Trump, the Trump administration, and ICE officials. So I just felt like it had many meanings for the film and for what was going on within the space that really resounded with me in terms of the filmmaking process.
I appreciate so much you bringing up the immigration component of this. Many of the women in the film and in the courtroom are immigrants. Some are applying for asylum. There are interpreters who are throughout the courtroom providing interpretation in multiple languages. And the overwhelming majority of the women are undocumented, whether Asian immigrants, Black, Latina, transgender youth. These are the people who make up the scores of people arrested for sex work. Judge Sarita, tell a little bit of the experience of presiding over a courtroom where those are the people who are making up the majority of the defendants that you're having come in front of you.
It's a very challenging process, but I think that that's why it's important when you have these problem-solving courts or these treatment courts to engage with the community. And right now we have at least like 9 different service provider organizations that collaborate with the courts and that provide services. And so we're very, very sensitive to the cultural specificity and also to the unique circumstances of each of the different groups that we see. So, for example, with our transgender defendants, we, you know, refer them to an organization called Community Healthcare Network that deals specifically with the transgender community. We have 4 or 5 different organizations that provide services in Mandarin or in Korean with the Asian population.
That's all the time we had for this interview this week, but you can find the full conversation on the podcast version of Off Kilter anywhere podcasts are found. And that does it for this week's episode of Off Kilter, powered by the Center for American Progress Action Fund. I'm your host, Rebecca Vallis. The show is produced by Will Urquhart and David Ballard. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Off Kilter Show, and you can find us on the airwaves on the Progressive Voices Network and the We Act Radio Network, or anytime as a podcast on iTunes. See you next week.
I want freedom. Freedom. But it's calling me back. I feel my spirit is revealing the mouth. We just trying to get freedom.